Hi, I'm Bill Maher, senior reporter for The Deal, where I cover the always colorful SPAC sector. On today's Drinks with The Deal, we welcome Mark Stone, senior managing director with the Gores Group, where he leads their SPAC program. Once a leading private equity investor, Los Angeles-based Gores is now a dominant SPAC sponsor, bringing 15 different vehicles public and completing 9 business combinations worth about $57 billion. Mark and I will talk about how his team approaches the SPAC space, from finding deal candidates to performing due diligence. We'll talk about the acquisition of Hostess Brands, one of the most successful SPACs ever. We'll look at how SPACs went from Wall Street darling to leper in just 2 years. We'll also examine a couple of partnerships put together by Gores and how those deals turned out. So without further ado, Mark, thanks for joining us and welcome to the program.
My pleasure, Bill. Thank you for having me.
So, Mark, do me a favor, just to begin with, can you give us a little background on how you came to lead Gores and what you did maybe before that?
Yeah, sure. So I've been at Gores for about 20 plus years now. Prior to coming to Gores, I was a serial CEO, mostly of transformative businesses or businesses going through significant change. I was introduced to Gores in the early 2000s, joined as their head of operations, business transformation. Did that for about 10 years, and then in 2014, picked up the baton to diversify us into the SPAC business. Since then, I've led our core franchise SPACs, so that's bringing seven different businesses public. As you said, about $54 billion in total transaction value across those seven transactions, $5.6 billion in terms of proceeds raised in those transactions. And then lastly, behind that, we put about $655 million of our own capital, Gores and affiliates, into those transactions. So I've been doing that ever since, been the CEO of all seven and a couple of the SPACs that we ended up winding down.
Okay. Well, let's backtrack to something you just said, because I think it's interesting and also it separates Gores from a lot of other sponsors. And that is the investment that Gores makes in the SPACs. Typically, on almost every SPAC, you see there are private placement units that are picked up and bought by the sponsor. But you're not talking about that. So do me a favor and take it apart a little bit.
Well, actually, we do inject the majority of our capital into our SPACs comes through our participation in the pipe, in the private placement. It's the most efficient way of us putting that capital in. Back in 2014, Alec Gores, the founder of Gores, and I got together and said, you know, we've been doing private equity for coming up on 30 years now. Be interesting to diversify into something new, but certainly something that didn't compete with where we were continuing to play in private equity. So instead of private, we went public with the SPACs and we went to a much larger size than what you'd find us doing in terms of business size in the private sector. So no competition at all. But, you know, SPACs back then, 2014, everything I heard was, you know, they're a four-letter word. They're where businesses go to get a deal done when they have no other place to go. It's where the desperate go. And we took a hard look at that and said, geez, is that because of the way SPACs are designed? I mean, the vehicle itself, or is it how people have used SPACs historically? And our hypothesis was it was the latter, right? That the playbook being used by most people when they were executing a SPAC was fundamentally off base. And so we came in and said, we want to write a new playbook. It was the playbook we used to buy Hostess. But a big piece of that, there were several key aspects around it, but one big piece was to make sure that we put our money where our mouth is, that we would go out and only ask other people to invest in a business that we were investing in ourselves. And so we would go out and raise a pipe and we would say, we're speaking for X percent or X many millions of dollars, tens of millions of the pipe ourselves.
Okay. Let me follow directly up on that for a minute, because the Hostess deal, if I remember correctly, was the first SPAC that I recall that did a pipe. And since then, pipes have become more or less standard equipment and not all the same size, obviously. But talk to me a little bit about the decision to try to bring a pipe on and also how that figures in terms of when you pursue a deal and you begin to, and you announce it and you're on the back end, which I think to a large degree is maybe the hardest part of it. Tell me how the pipe fits in, how you structure it.
Absolutely. So as I said, when we came in and looked at SPACs, we certainly didn't want to repeat what had historically been the SPAC pattern, which is you end up doing a deal or bringing a company public that really has no other options. It's exhausted everything on the private side. It isn't good enough to go public on its own. And so it leverages a SPAC vehicle. We said we actually want to go the complete 180 degree opposite. We want to only bring great businesses public. And we were so fortunate to land on Hostess as our first SPAC. Fast growing business, better margins than anybody else in their category. I can go on and on. But one of the things that we needed to bring to the table in the redesign of the playbook was capital certainty, because I will tell you, whether it goes down to the first conversations we had with the owners of Hostess, all the way down to conversations I had this morning with a potential target, everybody, while they may talk about value or this or that or the other thing when they talk about their key criteria, it really always comes down to capital certainty. We're looking to go public, and in going public, we want to raise X many hundreds of millions of dollars, right? Or billion plus dollars. And they want to make sure that capital is certain. So a huge piece of that for us was to go out and to raise a PIPE, because the PIPE is 100% committed before you sign and announce the transaction. So in going and raising that PIPE ahead of announcing the transaction, one, you brought a huge element of capital certainty. Two, the other thing that you've done is you've actually gone and tested the market, because the folks you're approaching on the PIPE are traditional public market investors. And so if you can raise, like in Hostess, I think we raised $375 million. If you can clear $375 million of capital raised by traditional public market investors, it goes a long way towards securing your belief that the remaining $350 million in trust is going to stay along for the ride as well. And thus, over the course of our seven transactions that I mentioned earlier, the largest set of redemptions we ever had was 20% in June of 2022 with Bullstar. Prior to that, and I think our track record in the first five was zero redemptions across all SPACs.
The redemption thing has really, I think, hit the sector hard, and I think it's shaken a lot of confidence, both on a sponsor side and as well as target. I'm wondering if you think that there's any wisdom to the idea of structuring SPACs such that you're rewarding shareholders for staying in and trying to give them a reason to stick around rather than, we traditionally see the hedge funds fall out in large number. Is there any wisdom to looking at the animal itself and saying, hey, maybe we can do something else?
We're always open. Look, when we got into SPACs, we recognized, as much as I said, we never thought the vehicle is perfect. I don't think it's perfect today. And so every engagement we have with advisors, with other sponsors that are out there that, you know, are repeat sponsors that we consider to be high quality sponsor, with legal advisors, we have tons of conversations on how can we evolve this product to make it better for all participants. And that is one of the things, right? But what I wouldn't want to do is go to a point where you're doing something to essentially provide incentive to those players not to redeem that goes materially beyond giving them an opportunity to invest in a really good company at a really good entry point. So when we would have conversations with folks around a PIPE, Hostess is a great example. I'll go back to their variable mobility. What people would say to us is, look, I have two options after you present this to me. Option one is to sit on the sidelines, right? And just wait to see how this performs. And if I really don't think it's going to, quote unquote, take off, I will have an opportunity to buy in. And if I get to buy in at 1050 versus 10, I'm not missing much. I won't be disappointed. But when you bring a Hostess to the table and you make the argument that you're buying in here, but we honestly believe this should trade at a premium to the comps, we believe it will move in that direction within inside 6 months. You're not actually pitching this, but they're reading between the lines of EBITDA and where we're bringing this to market at a discount to the comps, that there's every reason it should trade at a premium to the comps. They do the math and say, wow, this should fairly quickly become a $13, $14 stock. And so if I sit on the sidelines, I might miss that initial 20, 30, 40% upside. And that in and of itself got people not to redeem. And it paid for those folks. I mean, I think we were up over $15 with inside 4 months or so with inside Hostess, just because we brought it at the appropriate value, appropriate discount to the market and to the comps.
Okay. Well, let's stay with Hostess for a second. The deal came at an interesting time, I think, and the deal itself was an outlier, I think, in terms of the SPAC sector. You raised $375 million with the SPAC itself, and that year there were only 21 SPACs that were brought public, a far cry from what we've seen in the run-up. There were only nine D-SPACs the following year, where when you guys actually announced the deal and closed it, it only took 4 months, which today is unheard of. It simply couldn't happen. So take us back to how the Hostess deal came about and also how it worked through the process.
Sure. So many people asked us at the very beginning, are you going to be sector specific? Because when we got into SPACs, most SPACs prior were raised by sector specific executives. If you and I were from the auto industry, ex-auto guys, we'd go raise a SPAC, but it would be around the auto sector because that's where our Rolodex was built. That's where we felt we had the greatest advantage or leverage to be able to help companies on and on. We decided to instead go generalist, and we've been generalist ever since for one primary reason, which is what we care about most is the dynamics surrounding. We always call them partnerships, not transactions. We never view them as transactions. So around the company, around the partnership. So in this case, the business Hostess was actually owned by two different entities. One was Dean Metropoulos, who is a turnaround expert in the consumer products field, a guru, so to speak. And then the second was Apollo Global Management. And so they were equal partners, 50-50. Apollo wanted to get out. Private equity firm, they had held the asset for a period of time. They knew they were going to get a good return on the asset. They wanted to ring the bell and move on. And Dean did not. Dean felt there was so much more value to be created. He was very operationally involved in the business. He thought it had just been getting started. And so he decided he wanted to stay in. And so they were at a crisis point in some senses. And so we came in and said, hey, we think through a SPAC, we can provide you each with what you want, right? We can go raise proceeds. We can raise enough proceeds, Apollo, that you can be brought down to a small level in your retained ownership go forward. Dean, you can roll the majority, if not all of your ownership, if you'd like. And then what we would do is, to the extent the business is doing well, the stock is trading well, Apollo, you can 6 months when the lockup is off, 6 months later, the company can run a marketed offering and allow you to sell your remaining stake and be 100% out. And that's what we designed. And that's exactly what happened. And so Dean continued to be the single largest shareholder of the business. He continued to be the executive chairman. So he got what we want. And we were able to bring Apollo down and get them out. I think it was probably 6 months and 10 days later, they were 100% out of the investment. But to do that, we had to bring $725 million to the table. If they had done a traditional IPO, it would have maybe been $250, $300. So Apollo said, for those dynamics to work, we need $725 million in this SPAC transaction. And so we went out and said, okay, as you had said, $375 million in trust. We needed $350 in a pipe. When we secured the 350 in pipe with a really good set of investors, it gave confidence to both Dean and to Apollo that the money in trust would stay as well as it did. And we moved forward.
How many folks at GORS are involved in the SPAC program?
Many people we pull in, you know, subject matter experts and you know, forensic accounting people, et cetera, et cetera. But the core team that evaluate and really focus on driving the SPAC business, it's about five.
Okay. Now, you guys have been in SPAC land for a long time. You have seen the elephant and you've seen the market perform under different circumstances. Can you give me any sort of a sense in terms of how the process has changed in terms of how you approach a deal and how you work it from the introductory talks to a close? Has that changed at all?
Yeah, I still think we're targeting the same types of companies. If we're talking with somebody, I always say we're looking for growth-oriented businesses that have a clear element of differentiation, hopefully sustainable differentiation relative to their peers, right? Where existing ownership base is willing to bring that business to the market at the discount that's required to secure the capital that they want. It has a really strong management team that really can speak to and answer the questions around the go-forward business. And we should not underestimate that. At the end of the day, I've had so many investors when we pitch an opportunity to them say to me, look, we invest behind people, people with whom we have tremendous confidence. And so that management team being able to clearly articulate the value proposition go forward and then address head on any risks, any potential burdens that may be coming competitive or otherwise is absolutely key. And so today we do also target a specific size. I think the smallest transaction we did was about $1.5 billion. The largest was $20 billion. We like something kind of $2 billion and north just because we think something smaller than that now really doesn't get the attention of public market investors. And so if all of that criteria fits, we start with trying to understand what is it to the existing shareholder base? What is it you're looking to achieve? And in many cases, they might say, this is what we want to get 100% out. We don't care. And you get the management team that says, we really would like to stay private, in which case then we're not a good solution. But if something like a Hostess or a Vera Mobility or others come where they say, hey, look, we really do benefit by having access to the broader capital markets, and thus being public would absolutely make great sense. It'd bring great additional value to the company. And we need outsized proceeds relative to a traditional IPO, right? Or we have dynamics in our shareholder base where some want to roll and some others don't want to roll, or things like that. That's when I start to say, okay, we might have something here. And then you dig in, do some preliminary due diligence, and that usually lasts a couple of weeks, just to make sure you understand all the moving pieces and the key variables. We then put together a proposal, very simple. It's usually 3 pages, 4 pages. This is what we think the partnership could bring, to the extent that's absolutely acceptable to the other side. And you go back and forth a little bit. We then embark on 3 things simultaneously. One is getting the lawyers to start working on the definitive agreements. 2 is much more robust, detailed due diligence. And then the 3rd is going out and actually raising the pipe, to the extent there's a pipe involved, in which case there's been a pipe involved in every single one. And you do those 3 things concurrently, hopefully all ending at a point, kind of call it 75 to 90 days out, where you're signing and announcing the deal.
Let's go back to something you just touched on. Valuations in the SPAC world were pretty close to reality in 2019, early 2020. But once the SPAC sector picked up because of COVID and you moved into 2021, the valuations that we were seeing were much larger than what they had been in the past. I'm wondering, A, how you guys looked at the valuations in terms of getting to a deal, and B, evaluation in terms of due diligence, because frankly, one of the things I think that has brought the sector back down to earth with a thud has been bad deals with companies that shouldn't have been public in the first place. And I think if due diligence had stepped in for a larger role, some of those deals never would have seen the light of day. I know for you guys, you're pretty thorough, and I think you also look at this as a relationship business. So I think there's a lot of getting to know folks. Talk to me a little bit about that process.
Sure. As I said a few minutes ago, one of the things that we think is most critical is to have a management team that can articulate the go-forward story vision, but then stand up to what I might consider an all-out assault by some of these investors in terms of really probing on potential risk areas, how to mitigate risks and other concerns. And that's a huge piece of what we do in our due diligence. I also will add, we always add on our board, which is 100% independent. Our board absolutely is required from the get-go. Every single SPAC we've done, they've always required a separate independent third-party valuation report before they'll approve a transaction, which we think is extremely healthy. So they hired their own firm who goes out, does a whole bunch of stuff, and comes back and says, you know, we think the valuation being paid in this is fair, more than fair, something of the sort. So due diligence is critical. We do some in-house. We also leverage third parties for legal, certainly accounting, sometimes environmental, things like that. But it's a very thorough process to make sure that we understand what's going on. I think a lot of people didn't, I mean, we're a 30 plus year old private equity firm, but understand our roots are founded in what I'll call transformation value creation, which is, you know, our founder got into this business by buying a software business, $10 million in revenue that was underperforming. It was break even. Software businesses should generate 20, 25% net margins. He bought it for next to nothing because it was underperforming. He then transformed it over a 2.5 year period and sold it for significantly more than that which he paid. We had that embedded in our DNA all the way throughout our 30 plus years, which is, let's find businesses that are orphaned or underperforming. And part of our value creation process is not just traditional private equity financial engineering, but actually creating value by expanding margins, increasing EBITDA, growing revenue, things of that sort. And so we brought the same mindset in terms of our diligence from the PE side to this side. And we looked for businesses, as I said before, highly differentiated, growth oriented.
I'm thinking that Gore's status as a serial SPAC sponsor can be both a plus and a minus, perhaps at times. What are your thoughts about this? Because I'd imagine a track record that's successful would draw target companies to you. On the other hand, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're quality companies. And that doesn't necessarily mean you're not, in some ways, having to sift through companies that wouldn't have necessarily reached your radar to begin with. Talk to me about how that fits.
Yeah, I would say in the earlier, so think if we raised our first SPAC in 15, I'd say from 15 to probably mid part to towards back end of 20, that wasn't the case, because the only people that were coming and having conversations with us were people that fit that criteria I mentioned. And the numbers, you even articulated some of the numbers earlier around Hostess, the numbers were fairly small. When the market just took off, and it took off for two primary reasons, demand on both sides, literally almost overnight, the public investors went to a almost 100% risk-free point of view. And by risk-free, I mean, they went out and said, hey, not only are we willing to pay these higher valuations of which you spoke, but in addition to that, we're willing to start looking at more risky type companies. I mean, there were companies that went public off of a revenue multiple that was projected 6 and 7 years forward. I mean, these are venture type companies. Traditionally, public markets didn't touch venture type companies, but back then, risk was off. And so the demand to be able to find these companies and invest in these companies from a public standpoint was absolutely there. The second thing was advisors, boards, management teams who traditionally would never have a conversation with a SPAC were reaching out very proactively and saying, hey, we think this is a great opportunity for us to be able to raise capital by going public through a SPAC. And most of those, as you had said, Bill, if you look at 21 and into 22, and even there's a fall off today, but we're even getting them today, are people saying, we think we can go public through a SPAC and here's how we think about this. And they just don't deserve to be public. I don't think that they have the certainty around them to be public. And I'm not quite sure the management teams, given all the other challenges they have at their feet, have the company well built around what it takes to be a public company. And that ultimately is what flushed that. And from the market going from risk on to risk off is what really flipped the switch.
It was interesting to watch the phenomenon. I mean, in 2020, the IPO market essentially went to sleep because of COVID. And SPACs became essentially the only game in town. You guys were already there. And as we've talked in the past, I think it's pretty funny in that you'll find a SPAC sponsor team and they'll literally say, well, we can raise $250 million for God's sakes. And I think there were only 6 or 7 people in the country who didn't have a SPAC. I was one of them. But I think we've also talked about the idea that raising the money is actually the easiest part of the whole thing. After that is where the work honestly becomes a thing. Well, let's talk about 2021 for a minute, because it was probably the craziest year. There were 612 SPAC IPOs that year, and they were worth $144 billion. And I think behind closed doors, the SEC was losing its mind. The market was running away. They could not keep up with flow. And frankly, part of their charge is to protect investors. And that certainly goes toward retail investors. And in this case, I think they're trying to protect retail investors from themselves, which is even more difficult. For Gores, the registrations in 2021, there were a number of them. And you had 2 liquidations. You had a withdrawal, which I suspect is sitting comfortably in a confidential manner. The SEC at some point. You had a de-SPAC that came through, and you have actually one SPAC still trading from that 2021 registration. Tell me how you guys navigated those waters, because I think it's one thing for you guys to have a successful track record and know what you're doing. I think it's another thing to have so much of the oxygen being sucked out of the room and you having to run full speed still.
Yeah. No, and I think everyone out there was running full speed in 21 and probably well into the first half of 22. It was an amazing time. But here's what I'd say. So we went out and raised these, and we talked internally when we went and raised SPACs. Most of them were in the early kind of first quarter timeframe of 21. We knew that we had 2 years in which to find a company. We looked at the total aggregate. I mean, I think you just said 621 or something SPACs raised in that year. Look, the math just, it doesn't work if you think about it. Does in any one point in time, are there 621 high quality companies that are ready to be public and deserve to be public, ready to go public in a given year, maybe even 2 years? I don't think it. And then you have to layer on that. It has to be companies that want to go through a SPAC versus a traditional IPO. and then are ready in that window. So the math just eventually caught up with the market. We knew we were taking a risk and raising as many vehicles as we did. But as I said before, the demand was there. And not only did we have to sift through some of the things that you said, you know, earlier, which were the companies that we didn't move forward with, but we were having high quality conversations with multi-billion dollar companies like a United Wholesale Mortgage that we brought public that ended up closing in, I think, 2021. UWM, I think today that's a $12 billion, $14 billion company out there right now. So we were seeing enough of those that we said, look, we think we're in a cadre of serial sponsors. At that time, we had a banner that said no redemptions, that we can find amongst those interested in having public conversations, we can find the highest, the best of breed, and they will want to talk with us at a minimum, along with a few others, but we'll get an audience with them. And we would hope that that happened. But what we didn't count on was literally a year later, the door being slammed shut. So that kind of cuts. You have 2 years. If you cut a year out, actually the math works very much against you.
Tell me how Gores looks at companies post de-SPAC. When you look at a deal that's closed, the company is now public, it's off on its own. How do you measure the success of the deal? Because to me, there are different metrics, but I think those metrics don't necessarily dovetail with values of sponsors in terms of how they look at things. How do you guys measure success?
Well, if you wanted just one metric, it would be the stock price of the business. I think there are more than that. I think you can get into a black and white, and that's a good black and white. If you wanted to get into some of the gray, which I will in a second, you go into it. But look, ultimately, that's the metric. And I want to go back to, you know, across those seven deals, $655 million of our own capital and our affiliates' capital. We didn't have a fund that was investing, wasn't one of Gore's funds. It was the five people I mentioned earlier, part of the core team, Alec Gore's and others in the organization writing checks. So we put our money in. We wanted to make sure we believed in the companies and the management teams. And that's how we showed that. So I think that's the metric. But what you have to do in the gray is you have to realize we would always go back and say, okay, how is the business performing relative to what it said it was going to do? And so we're always going back every quarter when they're making their announcements and certainly at the end of the year and saying, okay, how does this bump up against what they said they would do, right? That's a little bit of the gray. Two is also, though, if you look at the stock price, the stock could actually be trading very well because the company's doing well, but it could actually be trading off or up because the sector is either up or down. So if you brought a business public, I mean, UWM was a great example. You know, we brought it out at a 4-turn discount to its next closest competitor, larger than they are, but at a 4-turn discount. That was a pretty material discount. But then what happened is interest rates started going up. When interest rates go up, fewer people want to apply for a mortgage, right? So the whole mortgage sector traded off. In fact, I would say that lead company that we brought to market at a 4-turn discount, they came down below our discount level, right? Just because the whole sector traded off. So at that point, you don't look at a UWM and say, this, the company is not performing. Actually, the company has performed extremely well against what they would say they do. The sector does. So you have to get into some of the gray.
Let's change gears for a minute. Gores does something, and you guys don't do a lot of it, but Gores does something that you don't see that often in the spec land, which is partnerships. Now, I realize that you look at each deal as a partnership. I'm talking about bringing people in next to you on the sponsor side. You've done it with Guggenheim, and you've done it with Dean. Talk to me about how those partnerships came to be and how they've worked.
Yeah, the first partnership we had was with Dean Metropoulos, called Gores Metropoulos, and we ultimately did a Gores Metropoulos too. And then later, we did a Gores Guggenheim, and Gores Guggenheim was the vehicle that was used to purchase Polestar, which was a spin out of Volvo and Geely in June of 22, I believe. But it started with Dean, which is, you know, we really had a wonderful time with Hostess. I went on the board of Hostess after it was brought public. I was on there for quite a bit of time and got to know Dean well. Alec and Dean had gotten to know each other well. And I think at that time, people started talking to Dean about, you know, hey, Dean, you're a really good investor. You're a really good serial CEO. You're a great turnaround expert and specialist in the consumer category. Don't you think you should raise your own SPAC? And Dean had those conversations with us about, hey, what does it take? What do I need? Because Dean really didn't have a team. And it was in that conversation that Alec said, well, look, maybe we should do something together because you have the lens and the capability on the consumer side, right? You have the pedigree. You know how to dissect these businesses and and do due diligence better than probably anybody else out there. We have the organization. We have the capability of knowing how to execute a successful SPAC from A to Z. And so if we put those two things together, we think that we can have great success. And so we did it. And that worked. And then later on, Guggenheim, it was interesting. We were talking to them about a potential opportunity. And Scott Minard had come to us and said, hey, look, we're thinking of doing our own SPAC, but we're having back and forth internally, et cetera, et cetera. And I think Al just said to Scott, why wouldn't we do something together? That's your way of kind of testing the waters before you go full, you know, just pure Guggenheim. And so that's how that came together.
Now, I'm not asking you to take a swing or speak out of school, but I do know enough about SPAC business and the transactions to know that there is some degree of ego involved. Now, when you bring two people to the same side of the table, there can be constructive back and forth, if you will. Tell me that the partnerships were all just smooth sailing.
Okay. That's like, I think if you say hedge funds or if you say private equity, I mean, many financial services type companies, you know, when you get to the more senior level, there are always egos involved. There are different agendas involved, right? There are different perspectives. And those things have to find a way to work out. It's not always smooth. And I wouldn't say all of these were smooth, but here's what I'd say. We've enjoyed working with Dean tremendously. I don't remember the last time we had any hiccups, bumps, or anything else like that. He's got a great relationship with Alec and Alec with Dean. Dean and I have a great relationship, and he's an extremely practical person. So while we may have a different lens, oftentimes we would defer to him because he understood these businesses better than we did. Mm-hmm. So that's it. And then Guggenheim, again, I think that one was, I would say, mostly smooth along the way. And maybe if there were any wrinkles, they weren't really within Gore's and Guggenheim. It was more of Guggenheim than thinking through what they really wanted to do and what they wanted to achieve on their end. And they might have had some internal different points of view. But other than that, we would do these partnerships again. It really, really, really worked out well. And tremendous respect for both partners.
Okay. Let's fast forward. Let's talk about where the SPAC market is today. Let me call upon our private raise data here for a minute. They're our in-house data provider. There have been 24 SPAC IPOs this year, and there have been 24 registrations. There have been 53 de-SPACs closed. And that doesn't necessarily mean they were announced this year and they've closed in the same year. I don't think that many have, because it takes longer these days. But give me an impression of how you guys view the market currently.
Yeah, I don't think, and I haven't combed through the data probably as well as you have, but I still think the majority of deals that are getting out there are on small companies. I would imagine the enterprise values are in the couple hundred million. I don't know how many of those 53 that you mentioned are above a billion and certainly above the threshold we've kind of set for ourselves, which is 2 billion. I do know one, Lionsgate, that was a couple billion dollars, I believe. That was great. That was a great transaction. I think when that got done and got done well, it was a nice pipe. I think redemptions were painfully low. So I think everybody kind of said, hey, look, the great deals can be done. This is a great example of the Harry did a great job there and the team from Lionsgate. So that was a really good deal. And I think kind of gave people faith that the SPAC market can go back to what it was in 16, 17, 18, 19, early 20. I think the rest of them are still small and companies that are trying to take advantage of this opportunity. And when you marry companies that need capital and are kind of, you know, this is maybe a last option with SPACs that really don't want to shut down, that's what's kind of coming together. So I still think there's an overhang. I think you're starting to see more interest in IPOs, new SPAC IPOs, which is great. It's refreshing. It's telling you that the public market still wants to invest. They still see the category as a relevant category. We think that's fantastic. So I think you'll see that starting to increase. But as you have mentioned this several times, raising a SPAC is the easiest part, right? Finding a great partner, a great target company is the next piece that's hard. It starts to get hard. And then by far the hardest piece is the back end, right? Securing that pipe, securing no redemptions, and setting the company off on a great trajectory for the new investors that have come in alongside of it. And that's the hard part. And hopefully we'll start to see great deals coming back. And I think we will. I think it's going to take some time. It's going to take well into next year, if not potentially the beginning of the year after.
Mark, I know from having called you in the past and had stories I was working on, and there have been times when you said, look, I'm buried and I can't get into that, or you're in the middle of a deal and you can't talk. I'm wondering when you're not working a deal, when you actually have a life, what is it you like to do?
Yeah, I mean, well, it's an appropriate time to ask, because if you had asked me in 21 and early 22, I probably would have said I don't have room for anything else. But I've got a wonderful family and we spend a tremendous amount of time together and have similar interests in what we like to do. I'm fairly active. And so get out and ski in the winter and, you know, get an opportunity to travel a good bit, which I enjoy. And then my wife and I have some philanthropic endeavors that we've undertaken recently. So we've put a lot of time and interest into those.
I'd like to thank Mark for joining us today and our producer, Robert Sims.
My pleasure, Bill. Thank you for having me.
For David Marcus, I'm Bill Maher for Drinks with a Deal. Until next time.